Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnton.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnes and your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Wednesday on this 21st day of October, 2015. And I'm very excited about a brand new guest that I've never had on Iron Sharpens Iron before, thanks to my friend Pastor Gary George of Sovereign Grace Chapel in Massachusetts. He informed me about this brother that was conducting a debate with a Muslim in Massachusetts, and he told me, "You've got to get Tony Costa on your program. You will not regret it." And Tony Costa has earned a BA and an MA in the study of religion, biblical studies, and philosophy from the University of Toronto. Tony received his PhD in the area of theology and New Testament studies from Radboud University in the Netherlands. He is a member of the Society of Biblical Literature, the Evangelical Theological Society, and the Evangelical Philosophical Society. His area of expertise is biblical and systematic theology, cults, the New Age movement, and comparative world religions with a specialization in Islam. Tony is also an ordained minister of the gospel. As a Christian apologist, Dr. Costa gives reasons for the valid belief in Christianity, and also advocates the unique claims of Jesus Christ. He also lectures at various universities and colleges on the existence of God, as well as the credibility of the Christian faith. Tony is a professor of apologetics with the Toronto Baptist Seminary. He also teaches with the School of Continuing Studies at the University of Toronto in the area of world religions. He also serves as adjunct professor with Heritage College and Seminary in Cambridge, Ontario, and Providence Theological Seminary in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He has lectured and ministered throughout Canada, the United States, and overseas. He is the author of Worship and the Risen Jesus in the Pauline Letters. Tony is happily married to a wonderful wife, has three children and a grandson, and resides in Toronto, Canada. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you to Iron Sharpens Iron for the very first time, Dr. Tony Costa.
Well, thank you, Chris, so much, and it's indeed an honor and a pleasure to be with you on this wonderful show of yours.
Yes, and we are going to be discussing today something that's very timely and something that definitely demands the attention of everyone on the globe, that is the migrant crisis and Islamic expansion in Europe that is currently taking place. And before we even go into that, I want you to give our listeners some background about yourself and how you came to know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior.
Yes, I was actually raised in a very religious Roman Catholic home. I was the son of Portuguese immigrants to Canada and raised in a very religious Roman Catholic home. I had no assurance of my salvation. I was very religious, but I was very lost. And so I always sought to have peace with God. I tried everything that the Roman Catholic Church could afford, and I still lacked that that assurance. And it was not until I was about 15 that two of my cousins had come to faith in Christ, and they shared the gospel with me for the first time. And they simply challenged me to read the Bible for myself and started reading it. I was seeking to actually prove them wrong, because I was trying to prove them that our Roman Catholic tradition was correct. And the more I read the scriptures, the more convicted I became. And it was through reading God's Word that I came to faith, and that was about when I was about 15. And then following that, I came across various other faiths, cults, and I was wondering why there was so much, what seemed to be so much religious confusion. And that eventually propelled me into the ministry of apologetics, and I knew that the Lord had a calling in my life to defend the faith, to equip the saints, and to give reasons for the Christian faith. And so that's what I do. I teach, as you noted, and I also equip students for giving answers for their faith, and I also engage in various debates with Muslims, atheists, Mormons, and everyone else.
Tell us something about Toronto Baptist Seminary.
Toronto Baptist Seminary is it's a Reformed Baptist seminary, and it was started, I believe, back in the early 30s by T.T. Shields, and who was also the pastor of the Jarvis Street Baptist Church in Toronto, one of the oldest Baptist churches here in the city. And it's a conservative seminary. We're privately funded because to receive funding from the government, we would have to compromise, and that would mean compromising some of our morals and so forth. So it's not an overtly large school, but it is a very faithful school. The motto of our seminary is Kata Christon, according to Christ. And so we train men and women here. We train men for pastoral ministry and also for mission work, women as well for missionary work. And some of our students, I'm proud to say, have moved on to doctoral studies, and some of them have actually gone out into the mission fields, particularly in outreach to Muslims.
And I know that one of your faculty members there, Dr. Michael Haken, he's going to be a guest on Iron Sharpens Iron, God willing, in the near future to discuss the Church Fathers and also to discuss John Owen.
So. Yes, he's a wonderful man, and Dr. Haken is indeed one of our star professors here.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to that interview very much. Tell us something about the background of why there is a migrant crisis in Europe currently taking place.
Well, the migrant crisis going on in Europe is, of course, an attempt for many of these thousands of people who are escaping the horror and the bloodbath that's going on under ISIS in both Iraq and Syria. The issue at hand, however, is that back in February of this year, ISIS said that they would send 500,000 migrants into Europe. So they threatened to send all these migrants into Europe. But they also claimed that among those 500,000 migrants, they would have 4,000 operatives, ISIS operatives, who were planning to establish and plant terror cells throughout Europe. The other problem here as well is it's been calculated that about 80% of these migrants actually are not from Syria. So they're not, 80% of them are not even of Syrian origin. And there's been a couple of warnings given by a number of people. The Lebanese education minister, for instance, Elias Boussab, met with British Prime Minister David Cameron and informed them that thousands of ISIS radicals were among the 1.1 million Syrians in the migrant camps, and he also went on to predict that 1 in 50 of these migrants are members of a terror organization, namely ISIS. And so the issue at hand here is that while we're hearing about the so-called refugee crisis, ISIS had already predicted this back in February, and the concern that many in Europe are having, and I'm not talking about the politicians, Chris, I'm talking about the average Europeans. The concern that they have is that this is going to serve as a segue for terrorists to come into the continent of Europe, establish terrorist cells. In fact, some of them have actually already been caught. And so this is the grave concern, is that with the flood of these migrants coming into Europe, there is an influx of terrorists coming in. And the other problem at hand here is that most of these are Muslims, and there is a worldview in Islam that sees itself as supreme over all other religions. There's an expansionist concept in Islam, a global vision that seeks to Islamicize the world. So there are a lot of concerns here.
What is the religious makeup of the migrants involved in this that are flooding different areas of Europe? I know that You said that many of them are Muslims. What, from what Muslim or Islamic sect are they from predominantly? And I'm assuming these are Muslims predominantly being persecuted by other Muslims, those who are not the terrorists coming in stealth, of course. But tell us something about the religious
people. Well, here's the irony, Chris. The irony here is that the majority of these Muslims are Sunnis, but ISIS is Sunni as well. And so this is what raises the question. The question is the Muslims that ISIS are killing are Shias, which form about 10 to 15% of the world's Muslim population. It's a completely different sect from the Sunnis, predominantly in Iran and Lebanon. But the Shias are being killed, and so are the Yazidis. The Yazidi girls who are captured and so forth. The Yazidis are a small sect in Islam. They're also being attacked because they're deemed to be heretics. So the irony here is that the majority of these migrants are Sunnis, the very denomination that ISIS belongs to. And so the question is, are these people truly refugees, or are they simply trying to all migrate to Germany so that they can have a better living and so forth? So here's the irony. These are not majority Shias, which would be people who would be persecuted, and they're not majority Christians. There are a lot of Syrian Christians as well, but they are not the majority. The majority are definitely Sunni Muslims.
And has there been any reason given by leadership among the persecuted victims who are Sunnis as to why their own Sunni brethren are persecuting them?
Are you referring to the Sunnis that are among the migrants?
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Well, the question is, if they're being attacked or persecuted, it's because they're not upholding the Sharia. The Sharia, of course, is the law in Islam. And if they're not living the Sharia or following the Sharia law under the dictates of the leadership of ISIS, then they would be deemed hypocrites. And then, according to the Quran, hypocrites are to be killed as well. So that's the only reason where a Sunni, the ISIS group, would kill any of the Sunni Muslims, is if they deemed them to be hypocrites or not fully following the Sharia law.
Now, is there any, I don't know if there's been any in-depth interviews done or press conferences or anything like that, but if these migrants are Sunnis, are they merely nominal Muslims, or are they interpreting Sharia law differently? What's going on there that you would have so many identifying themselves as Sunni and then being persecuted because they are not even adhering to the very basic Islamic teachings that would be upheld by Sharia law?
Well, it's interesting, Chris, because many of these migrants that were vetted by a number of the authorities in Europe, what they found actually was that many of them had cell phones, and on the cell phones they actually had videos of ISIS beheadings and all types of atrocities that were going on. What I think is happening here is I think they simply want to move on to Europe because they know that, particularly Germany, that's where the majority of them have migrated to, into Germany. They want what they deem to be a better life, but the problem here is that they're still Muslims at heart. And the issue here is that they are devoted to a worldview that still sees Islam as supreme. Sharia law is superior to Western law. And so the question is this also a move to potentially Islamicize Europe? And I think it is, because one of the most important events in the life of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, was that in the year 622 AD, Muhammad fled from Mecca to Medina. This is known as the Hijra. And this was the migration. The word Hijra in Arabic means to migrate. And when Muhammad migrated from Mecca to Medina, one of the very first things he did was he built a mosque. And it was in Medina that Muhammad began to receive the revelations to subjugate the unbelievers and to bring them under Sharia law. And so this is the concern of many people, particularly people in Hungary, and Hungary has got a lot of flack because they didn't want any of these migrants. The real question, Chris, that we should be asking here is, Why is it that Saudi Arabia and all the oil-rich Gulf states have not taken in one refugee? I mean, after all, these are their Muslim brethren.
Right.
And they have not taken one of them in. And the reason that they gave for not accepting any refugees is they are concerned about the national security of their nations. And for the very same reasons I gave you, they've also said there may be terrorists among their group. And so they're simply trying to protect their own national interests. However, Saudi Arabia has graciously offered Germany funds to build 200 mosques all over Germany to provide for all these refugees or these migrants. So they have no problem giving up the money to build mosques to expand the Islamic hegemony, but they do not want any of these migrants in their borders, within their borders. So that's very telling.
Yeah, I would say. in your opinion, I don't know if how much knowledge you have about percentages, but what is your view of how what percentage of these migrants are in fact merely trying to spread Islam and coming under the guise of being persecuted falsely?
Well, I would say that in Islam, Christianity differs from Islam in that Christianity, which is the basis, the Judeo-Christian principles of Western society, believe in the separation of church and state, which is fundamental to Western democracy. In Islam, however, there is no separation of mosque and state. It's one. It's a unitary worldview. And so the majority of these Muslims, while they will go to the West and enjoy its economy and so forth, we must never forget that still at heart, they believe in the Quran. They believe Muhammad is the best example that men should follow. He's the prophet of Allah and so forth. At the center of their faith is the belief that Islam teaches them that migration, the Quran teaches that migration is permitted to Muslims on the basis that they will spread the Islamic faith. That's right in the Quran. And so if they're going to migrate, the Quran says, they must migrate with the intention of spreading the religion of Allah and His Messenger. So I would say that, I mean, I don't have the exact figures here, but I would say that Muslims, if they are true to their faith, they must uphold the principle that they are called to engage in jihad, and jihad doesn't always necessarily mean physical warfare, but jihad in Arabic means to strive, to struggle. And part of the striving and struggle of the Muslim is to expand the Islamic faith. So Christianity is a global religion as well. We have a global vision to take the gospel to the whole world and make disciples of all nations. But of course, the means of doing so, as you know, Chris, is to do so through love and depending on the Lord. However, in Islam, the way that the faith is to be spread, there's three stages. Maybe I can discuss that later. There are three stages that Islam sets down.
Well, you could discuss it right now if you like.
Okay, very good. In Islam, Muhammad laid down three stages of jihad. The first stage is called the peaceful stage, and that's where he taught, when you're in the minority, to be tolerant, to basically teach Islamist peace and to get along with the unbeliever and so forth. But that's only supposed to be a temporary measure until the Islamic community begins to increase. Now, as it increases in numbers, the second stage that Islam dictates is what's called defensive jihad. And this is where the community begins to make certain demands, special demands like halal sections in the grocery stores, demands to provide prayer rooms for them in universities, colleges, in the workplace. In other words, using Western laws against the unbeliever to advance Islam. The third stage is known as offensive jihad, and this is when the Islamic community becomes strong enough that they can take over and topple the unbelieving government. And this is what we saw in Iraq and in Syria when President Obama withdrew the final troops that were there. He left a vacuum there, and ISIS took the opportunity to come in and take over, which they did very quickly. We saw this in Egypt with the so-called Arab Spring, which actually was a winter, when you think about it, a blizzard, where Mubarak was toppled by Mohamed Morsi, who was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, a noted terrorist organization. And the moment the Muslim Brotherhood took over Egypt, you will notice they started implementing Sharia law immediately. And so those are the three stages. When you are in the minority, you play nice, you get along, and then the whole idea is that when you become greater in numbers, then the opportunity will come for you to basically impose Sharia law, depose the unbelieving, or the kafir, the Quran calls them, the kafir, the unbelieving government. And this is why, when you think about it, Chris, the birth rate among Europeans is what? About 2.3 kids per family. The birth rate among Muslim families are about 6 to 8 per family. In simple mathematics, you give them another 50 years or so, you could see that the face of Europe is going to change dramatically. So the demographics are definitely going to change, and Europe will become predominantly Muslim.
So this is right now specifically Germany that's being flooded with migrants, or are there other areas?
There are other areas, but Germany has received the bulk of these migrants. And Canada as well. We just have a newly elected prime minister who unfortunately has very ungodly views. He is very pro-Islam. And so we're very concerned right now. We just had an election up here. But he wants to bring in about 25,000 migrants into Canada. I know President Obama has been talking about bringing thousands of migrants into the United States as well. So I have nothing against migration. My parents, I'm the son of immigrant parents, but you see, Chris, when my parents came here, they integrated with society and they pay their taxes and so forth. And what's happening in many cases is a lot of these migrants are not integrating into society. They're separating. They're forming separate communities. And a lot of that has to do with the Quranic injunction that they're not supposed to befriend Jews and Christians.
I'd like to announce our email address if you'd like to join us on the air with a question for Dr. Tony Costa. Our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. That's chrisarnzen, C-H-R-I-S-A-R-N-Z-E-N, @gmail.com. If you have a question on the migrant crisis and Islamic expansion in Europe, or if you have a general question on Islam as well, we'll accept that in addition to the specific topic that we have at hand. chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please include your first name at least, the city and state where you live, and the country where you live if you reside outside of the United States. That's chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Now, is there evidence that any of these migrants are genuine victims of persecution?
Well, there are some, and those are mainly Yazidis, Christians, predominantly Christians. In fact,
like Coptic, Coptic,
Coptic and Persian, that is Christians from Iran, particularly those who, the ones who are most susceptible are those who are converts, that is Muslim converts to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, there was a story in one of these migrant camps of a Christian migrant who was brutally beaten simply because he had admitted or confessed that he was a convert from Islam to Christianity, and he was badly beaten. The authorities had to come in and get him out of there. But the question remains: you're on European soil, you're under Western law, you're no longer under your Sharia law, and so why are they attacking so-called apostates? Well, again, they're attacking apostates because under Sharia law, which is the law of Allah, the supreme law, the divine law, apostates are to be killed. And so what we're finding is that even in Western countries, Muslims are imposing Sharia. There are countries in Europe, like Belgium, for instance, and others, where there are various locations that are basically Sharia enforced. There are no-go zones for non-Muslims.
Are there, I should say, areas of the UK that are like that?
There are some areas in the UK, smaller areas, where, yes, some Muslims were trying to do this. The police did get involved and basically told them they cannot do that. What they were doing, Chris, was they were basically, if someone walked through a Muslim neighborhood with a bottle of wine in their bag, they would grab this from the individual and basically drain it down the sewer. In other cases, they would attack transvestites or homosexuals and so forth, and basically tell them you're in a Muslim area, get out of here. They would threaten their lives and so forth. So the problem here is it's not this integration. It's not the melting pot mentality where everyone just becomes an American when they come to that country. The idea here is that there's this segregation where you have these Muslim pockets of Muslim communities. When I was in London just a month ago or so, I was in an area of London which was heavily populated by Muslims, and I found it quite interesting that the former Prime Minister Tony Blair, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who lived in that area, had armed police in front of his home. So it's quite interesting when you really think about it.
And we're going to be going to a station break right now. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question for Dr. Tony Costa about Islam in general, or specifically about the migrant crisis and Islamic expansion in Europe, our email address again is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. And we ask that you please at least give your first name, your city and state of residence, and your country of residence. If you live outside of the USA, if you're calling about something that is personal or private or something that perhaps makes you too nervous to identify yourself, you may remain anonymous. But otherwise, please at least give us your first name and your location of residence. And we're going to be right back after these messages. So don't go away. We're going to be right back with Dr. Tony Costa.
Attention coin collectors and investors. Long Island Galleries of Wading River, New York has brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars for only $54 per coin, with free shipping and handling for a limited time. There's a 40-coin limit, so order now while supplies last. Call 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express welcome. Prices subject to change, so call now at 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. If you prefer ordering your brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars by check, mail it today to Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. That's Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. Remember, they're only $54 per coin with free shipping and handling and a 40-coin limit. New York State residents must add sales tax. Long Island Galleries is honored to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. See the Long Island Galleries display ad at ironsharpensironradio.com.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com, and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Thrive and Financial is not your typical financial services provider. As a membership organization, we help Christians be wise with money and live generously every day. And for the fourth year in a row, we were named one of the world's most ethical companies by the Ethisphere Institute, a leading international think tank dedicated to the creation, advancement, and sharing of best practices in business ethics. Contact me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433 Again, 717-254-6433 to learn more about the Thrivent Difference.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you've just tuned us in, our guest today is Dr. Tony Costa, who is on the faculty at Toronto Baptist Seminary in Canada, and we are discussing the migrant crisis and the Islamic expansion in Europe. And if you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnesen@gmail.com, chrisarnesen@gmail.com. I do want to thank Pastor Gary George of Sovereign Grace Chapel in Southbridge, Massachusetts, for recommending my guest today. And because of that, I'm going to give Pastor Gary a plug. The website for Sovereign Grace Chapel in Southbridge, Massachusetts is sovereigngracema.org. Sovereigngracema for Massachusetts.org. I'd also like to thank our good friends at Providence Baptist Church in Norfolk, Massachusetts, for being a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And Pastor Mark Lukens and the congregation view this program as being valuable enough to put us on their monthly budget. And I want to thank them from the bottom of their heart, for viewing us in this light and for supporting us and encouraging us and enabling us to remain on the air with their financial help. And Providence Baptist Church of Norfolk, Massachusetts can be found on the internet at providencebaptistchurchma.org, providencebaptistchurchma for Massachusetts.org. And we once again thank you, Pastor Mark Lukens and Providence Baptist Church of Norfolk, Massachusetts. Tony, the migrant crisis that we are experiencing, are the Muslims that are claiming, at least, that they are persecuted, what specifically are they violating in, according to their own profession in regard to Sharia law, if they're being persecuted?
Well, the only thing that they would be persecuted for, again, is if they're not following the standard view of ISIS in terms of Sharia. So if they object to, for example, ISIS has established the caliphate under Baghdadi, who they believe to be the head of the Islamic State. So Muslims who would rebel against Baghdadi, like the caliphate, for instance, Muslims who would steal from ISIS. Just recently, they killed a few people who stole from them and so forth. So these would be Muslims who would be deemed to be hypocrites by the leadership of ISIS and killed, or if they're convicted as spies, if they're seen to be spies working for the West, they would be seen as traitors and then they would be killed.
Now, obviously, we as Christians are supposed to be compassionate, and when we hear of people who are being persecuted, even if they're not Christians, we should have a heart for a heart of compassion for them.
Yeah.
How do you sift out those that are truly victims of this and those that are just terrorists in disguise, wolves in sheep clothing?
Well, it's interesting, Chris, because our former prime minister up here in Canada, Stephen Harper, wanted to affect these migrants and pay closer attention to Christians and Yazidis and all those who truly are being persecuted, killed, and raped, and so forth. He got in trouble for even suggesting that because they thought you should just pick them indiscriminately. The only problem is that in Islam, there's also the doctrine of taqiyya, and taqiyya teaches that it is permissible to lie to the unbeliever. And so we're up against a couple of problems here. Number one, you've got an Islamic worldview that sees all other religions as beneath Islam, especially Judaism and Christianity, which are taught to be perversions in the Quran of the true religion of Jesus and Moses. So you've got that problem. But you've also got the issue of taqiyya, which means that under the Quran, Muslims under duress can lie. They can also lie to advance Islam. But then the other problem here is that, as you just rightly noted, Christians are obligated by our Lord's command to love even our very enemies. So I think what we need here, Chris, is we do definitely need a vetting process. I think we need to be wise as serpents and gentle as doves and realize that, yes, we are called to love our neighbor. Yes, we are called to love our enemies. But at the same time, we cannot throw reason out into the air and forget that Islam is not just a religion. It is also a political ideology. It is both religious and political at the same time. You cannot divorce those two concepts. What it means is vetting people, and those who come into Western countries, have to make it clear that they are going to obey the laws of those Western countries that they're entering into. There's a lot of pushback, in the West by a lot of Muslims who are basically saying, we don't care about democracy. Particularly in England, in London, there have been a lot of protests where Muslims have basically held signs saying democracy go to hell and, Sharia is the answer and so forth. So we must bear in mind that in the minds, of Muslims, first and foremost is the Sharia, which is the Muslim law. And under Sharia law, there's certain things that are taught that are incompatible with Western values. So, for instance, they reject freedom of expression, freedom of speech. You cannot just say whatever you want about Muhammad. Look what happened to the cartoonist, Charlie Hebdo, in Paris.
Right.
You cannot say anything derogatory about Muhammad. You probably have seen what's happened with Robert Spencer and Pamela Geller. I believe it was in Garland, Texas, where two shooters went down there to kill them for having an art exhibit on Draw Muhammad Day and so forth. Now, I'm not into provoking people of any religious stripe, but I do understand that under the First Amendment, people do have the right to be offensive. People do have the right to say things, even if it offends a religious group of any sort. But it's quite interesting, isn't it, Chris, that in Western society, in the United States and Canada and in Western Europe, it's perfectly fine to mock Jesus Christ in art, in comedy, in cartoons, but you'll notice that the same right is not afforded to the Islamic faith, and that's simply because under Sharia law, to mock Muhammad, the prophet, is to incur the death penalty.
Do you know anything about the sect of Islam? I may be mispronouncing it, but Ahmadiyya?
Yes.
Ahmadi, yes. As I think they're also called.
Yes.
I understand that they are genuinely a peaceful sect because they believe that their Messiah has come and done away with all acts of violence that are commanded in the Quran and the Hadith.
Right. The problem with the Ahmadiyyas is the Ahmadiyyas originated in India in the mid-1800s, and they follow a man by the name of Ghulam Ahmed, Mirza Ahmed, who they believe to be the Mahdi, the promised one in Islam, but also they believe him to be the second coming of Jesus Christ. Many Ahmadiyyas will not tell you that, but they claim that he is the second coming of Jesus Christ.
No, who won't tell you that? I'm sorry?
The Ahmadiyyas, generally, at first, will not tell Christians this.
Oh, but they do secretly believe it, though.
They do. They do believe it. And, in fact, in my debates with them, they have openly confessed it. In fact, in one of my debates, we have one of their imams on video openly admitting that Mirza Ghulam Ahmad is the second coming of Jesus Christ. However, they are seen as heretics by mainstream Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because they teach that there was a prophet after Muhammad.
Right.
And that is taboo, that is blasphemy, sacrilegious, because in Islamic teaching, the Quran says that Muhammad is the seal of the prophets, and therefore there are no prophets after him.
Mm-hmm.
So the Ahmadiyyas are actually brutalized. They're killed in Pakistan, in Indonesia. So they're not actually seen. They are to Muslims what Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons are to us. They're considered a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And they do take the sayings of their teacher as, let's say, as new light. But you cannot read the Quran and walk away, especially chapter 9 of the Quran, which is the last revealed chapter called the Surah of the Sword, which gives the marching orders for Muslims to engage in jihad. You cannot walk away from the Quran and not know that the Quran does mandate violent subjugation of the unbelievers.
Now, are any of those involved in the migrant crisis Ahmadiyya?
No. Ahmadiyyas are primarily in Pakistan, in India, Indonesia. The ones who are moving out of Syria and Iraq are predominantly Sunni Muslims. But I've got an interesting quote here, Chris, from, you remember Muammar Gaddafi?
Yes.
Who led Libya. Mm-hmm. I want to bring a quote here for you. He said this, quote, "We have 50 million Muslims in Europe. There are signs that Allah will grant Islam victory in Europe, not without swords, without guns, without conquest. He will turn it into a Muslim continent within a few decades." Now, that's quite interesting. It's almost prophetic.
Hmm.
He says that Europe will become Muslim, not with swords, not with guns, not with conquest. They will do so by simply populating it with Muslims.
Now, was he really a fundamentalist Muslim, Gaddafi?
Well, he was a Sunni Muslim. He was huge on expanding Islam. But his very lifestyle, he cavorted with a lot of women. He had a so-called harem of women. So he was a dictator. I would say he was a corrupt dictator.
Mm-hmm.
But he did truly believe. I mean, he always claimed to be a devout Muslim. He claimed that he believed in the expansion of Islam. In fact, he even tried to convince a number of diplomats to convert to Islam. But he was nonetheless a corrupt dictator. But in Islam, Chris, you have to understand that in Islam, the idea is that in the end, it's all based on the scales of justice of Allah. The idea in Islam is that if your good works outweigh your bad works, even if it's 51% good and 49% bad, you will enter paradise. So the Muslim pilot who flew the one of the planes into the Twin Towers in New York, the night before he flew the planes into the towers, he was drinking it up, and he was in a strip bar. These are things that are considered harem, or unclean in Islam. But he was doing it because he understood that his act of jihad would purify him of all those sins. So it's a brownie point religion, where if you do more good than bad,
mm-hmm.
then you will make it into paradise.
Now, Saddam Hussein, on the other hand, he was clearly just a nominal Muslim, wasn't he?
Yes. Considered a nominal Muslim, but interestingly enough, Christians in Iraq lived much better and much more peaceful under Saddam Hussein.
That's what I've heard, yes, by missionaries.
Yeah, absolutely. They lived much more comfortably under Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and also with President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. Christians or Copts there, the Egyptian Christians there, lived relatively peaceful. But ever since the Muslim Brotherhood came into power, they started burning down churches. They started killing many of these cops and so forth. So there are cases where you do have these nominal Muslims like Mubarak and Hussein, but they're not being consistent. When they apply consistently the rules of Sharia, then what you see ISIS doing, that is a true reflection of what Sharia law looks like, what an Islamic state is supposed to look like.
Now, Ahmadinejad in Iran is a true Orthodox Muslim, correct?
Yes, he is Shia. He would be considered a heretic by the Sunnis.
Hmm.
He is a Shia. He is a Shia. Most of Iran are Shia. But he definitely believes that Israel as a nation should be destroyed. In fact, this is part of Islamic eschatology, that the end will not come until all the Jews are slaughtered. And so in one of the prophecies of Muhammad found in the Hadith, he actually said the final hour will not come until all the Jews are killed. And he said that even a tree will call out and say, "Muslim, there's a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him." So the eradication of Israel is part of Islamic eschatology to bring in or usher in the end, including the coming of the Mahdi.
Now, what would be the primary difference between the Shia and the Sunni that has them killing each other?
The primary difference has to do with the succession of Muhammad. The Sunnis don't believe that Muhammad left any family successors, no sons or daughters. Even though he did have an adopted son, he repudiated his adoption to his son, Zaid, and he did have a daughter, Fatima. However, the Sunnis believe that after Muhammad died, Muhammad had appointed that the Islamic Empire should be ruled by what's called the caliphs, the caliphate. And the caliphs are basically the head of the Islamic State. And so there were four of them in early Sunni Islam, basically Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. Now, the Shias came to disagree with the Sunnis. The word Shia means party. So this was the party of Ali. Ali was the cousin of Muhammad and also his son-in-law. And they believed that the succession should go through his family. And they believed that Ali was the rightly appointed successor of Muhammad. And this led to a huge bloodbath. Even back about 50 years after Muhammad's death, there was this huge bloodbath. And eventually Ali was killed in battle, as was his family. And so ever since that point, the Shias and the Sunnis have had nothing but daggers in their eyes for each other. They see each other as heretics. The Shias accuse the Sunnis of killing the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, Ali. The Sunnis argue that the Shias went against Muhammad's orders to follow the caliphs and so forth. But the Shias believe that there is a coming Mahdi. Now, the Sunnis do as well, but this is more prominently a Shia belief that the Mahdi, it will come to the world, and he will actually come after Jesus Christ. Because Muslims do believe that Jesus Christ will return, but the average American, Canadian, Westerner doesn't understand that the Islamic version of the second coming of Jesus is that he comes back as a jihadi, first to destroy Christianity. He will destroy Christianity and also rebuke his followers for believing that he died on the cross, for believing that he was the Son of God. And Jesus will figure prominently in the end as a prophet who will bring the world under submission to Islam. That's their eschatological view.
It sounds a lot like the battles that have gone on in organized crime. I mean, it's because they're really not doctrinally different, are they, in any significant way?
Doctrinally, there's just a few differences, but fundamentally, on the fundamentals, they believe that there's only one God, that is Allah, and he is a Unitarian God, mm-hmm. not Trinitarian. They deny the Trinity.
Right.
He's only one person in the Godhead. They believe that Muhammad is his last messenger. They believe the Quran is his last revelation. They believe that the Bible has been corrupted by Jews and Christians, even though the Quran does not support that. Muslims have developed a doctrine that the Bible has basically been corrupted by its followers and so forth. So the Sunnis believe that the Quran as an eternal text existed in heaven prior to its revelation to Muhammad. The Shias don't believe that. They don't believe that the Quran is eternal. They believe that it had a beginning and time. So that would be another major difference between the two, the nature of the Quran as the Word of God.
Now, is there any way or place or arena where the Sunni and the Shia and some of the other sects of Islam put their differences aside and actually unite in any significant way? Go ahead.
Yes, and they do. Well, first of all, their hatred for Israel is one. So Hezbollah is a primarily Shia terrorist organization. Hezbollah up in Lebanon has been trying to destroy Israel for a number of years now. And of course, the Palestinians are predominantly, they're all Sunnis. And so other Sunni countries will side with Iran and Lebanon in trying to destroy Israel. Another area is Sunnis and Shias will actually stand shoulder to shoulder in executing people who blaspheme Muhammad. So one of the most famous examples was in the late 80s when Salman Rushdie wrote his book, The Satanic Verses.
I just saw him interviewed recently again.
The Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa, an Islamic judicial decree, to have Salman Rushdie killed for mocking the Prophet. Interestingly enough, the Sunni world joined with Iran, and Yusuf Kardawi, who is the present Mufti of the Muslim Brotherhood, at that same time in the late 80s, he also came out in total agreement with Khomeini to have Salman Rushdie killed. And of course, our favorite pop singer at the time, I don't remember in the 70s, remember that?
Cat Stevens.
Cat Stevens, yes. Cat Stevens, his very well-known pop songs. Cat Stevens converted to Islam. He's now known as Yusuf Islam. And he also at the time, on live TV, openly said that that Salman Rushdie should be killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
For mocking the Prophet. So there are times when Muslims will join together, even the condemnation of the so-called Muhammad cartoons. Shias and Sunnis will join forces in areas like that to attack or to kill those who would mock the Prophet.
Now, when you say they join forces, are you actually, I'm not talking about just with an ideology, are you meaning like side by side, comrades in arms, if you will?
Yes. I mean, if a Sunni was to kill Salman Rushdie, or if a Shia would kill them, I mean, a Sunni and a Shia would basically pat them on the back and say, you know, you did the right thing. And incidentally, Pamela Geller, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Pamela Geller with Atlas Shrugged, she's currently right now under protection in the United States. The FBI has actually blamed her for this because she was one of the creators of the Draw Muhammad Day in Garland, Texas, along with Robert Spencer. So Pamela Geller, at the present moment, is in serious danger for her life, and she has 24-hour security following her.
Now, what is her background?
She's Jewish. She's a Jewish girl, and she got involved in this whole area after 9/11. She was shocked at in the aftermath of 9/11, and she became very concerned with the expansion of political Islam.
Going back to Cat Stevens. What group, what sect is he a part of?
He's Sunni.
Because it's interesting that he publicly was agreeing with the death sentence looming over the head of Salman Rushdie when he was in hiding. And yet then we in the United States have him a part of a concert after 9/11. To promote some kind of solidarity between Muslims and others. I mean, that was pretty
right.
I mean, has he recanted any of those views, or is he?
No, he has not recanted any of those views.
Yeah,
so. And he's simply following. And you know, in the Hadith, it's very clear. Muhammad said, "Whoever leaves this religion, kill him." But Muhammad also made it a practice. And the word Sunni comes from the word Sunnah. The Sunnah in Arabic means the pattern, the model of the Prophet. So in the Quran, Muhammad is set out as the exemplar for all humanity. In Christianity, it's Christ. We follow the imitatio Christi. Christ is the one that we imitate. But in Islam, Muhammad is the exemplar. And Muhammad would routinely have people who spoke against him, wrote against him, wrote poetry against him, and mocked him. He would routinely have these people killed. And he would call his followers to get rid of them. So when you hear Muslims in Paris killing all these journalists and artists in the Charlie Hebdo massacre, one of the things that one of the killers said was, "We have avenged the Prophet Muhammad." So they are simply following the pattern that has been set down in the Sunnah, which again is the pattern of the Prophet.
And going back, I know that you mentioned. I can't think of his name right now. Perhaps I'll come back to that now because I was
Gaddafi.
I'll have to come back to it because his name slips my mind. The militant Muslim figure in the 80s from Iran.
Ayatollah Khomeini?
Yes. Was he Shia?
Ayatollah Khomeini.
Was he also Shia?
Yes, he is. Iran is predominantly Shia.
So the Ayatollah Khomeini, well, the original one is dead, though.
And
he was also Shia, you're saying.
That's correct. They're all Shia.
Right. And what is the predominant makeup of Muslims here who have immigrated to the United States? I say here, you're Canadian.
Yeah.
Let me blend in North America.
Okay.
The predominant makeup of Muslims in North America.
They're predominantly Sunni. Predominantly Sunni. Because Sunnis are about 85% of the world's Muslims. The Shias are 10 to 15%. But it's interesting in Dearborn, Michigan, where you have, where it's been dubbed the Mecca of the United States, in Dearborn, Michigan, there is a predominant Shia presence there.
And although they haven't reached the stage of violence yet, they're sort of bordering on their own little Sharia law there, aren't they?
Well, they are. I mean, you probably heard there in the United States how these Christian bakery stores were being sued for not making wedding cakes for same-sex couples for their weddings and so forth. People there got sued and lost their business and so forth. Interestingly enough, there was an undercover video done in Dearborn, Michigan, where four different bakeries were interviewed by someone posing as a same-sex adherent. And when he asked these bakers if they would do a wedding cake or a gay wedding, every one of them refused. But yet, if you notice the media is not running after Muslim bakers. They're running after Christian bakers and making it a national case. And basically, the LGBT community has their targets on the church.
Right.
Not so much on Islam.
Well, it could be that they're terrified for their lives.
Yes, because ISIS has been throwing them off buildings, top of buildings, and then they're stoned to death. Well, that's Sharia law as well. And the irony here, Chris, we have it up here in Canada too, is we have members of the LGBT community that are very strongly pro-Palestinian. And yet the irony here is that in Israel, homosexuals have equal rights. Israel, as a secular state, they recognize the same-sex relationships. But in the Palestinian territories, you could be killed for being a homosexual.
We're going to be going to another station break before we start our second hour on our interview with Dr. Tony Costa. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. We do have a couple of listeners that have already emailed us and are waiting for you to address their questions. The email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Please at least include your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the U.S. And please, unless it is a sensitive area where you insist on remaining anonymous, we ask if you please at least give your first name. But we understand if you request to remain anonymous, we will respect your wishes. chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Tony Costa of Toronto Baptist Seminary.
Attention coin collectors and investors. Long Island Galleries of Wading River, New York has brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars for only $54 per coin, with free shipping and handling for a limited time. There's a 40-coin limit, so order now while supplies last. Call 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express welcome. Prices subject to change, so call now at 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. If you prefer ordering your brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars by check, mail it today to Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. That's Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. Remember, they're only $54 per coin with free shipping and handling and a 40-coin limit. New York State residents must add sales tax. Long Island Galleries is honored to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. See the Long Island Galleries display ad at ironsharpensironradio.com.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Tired of box store Christianity? Of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience, featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
Introducing 1031 Sermon Jams. Sermon Jams.
But now for the good news. That sounds like sweet music in the hellbound sinner's ears, especially if you're like me and you know that you don't need Romans 3 to remind you of how wicked you are.
If you would like to learn more about 1031 Sermon Jams, visit us at our website at 1031sermonjams.com or follow us on Twitter or Facebook.
It's about God and His glory, and the gospel is about man and his sin.
Are you a Christian looking to align your faith and finances? Then you'll want to check out Thrivin Financial. We're not your typical financial services provider. We're a not-for-profit Fortune 500 organization that helps our nearly 2.4 million members be wise with money. We provide guidance that reflects your values so you can protect what matters most. We help members live generously and strengthen the communities where they live, work, and worship. Learn more about the Thrivin story by contacting me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you've just tuned us in, our guest today for the last hour has been Dr. Tony Costa of Toronto Baptist Seminary, and we are continuing our discussion with him about the migrant crisis and Islamic expansion in Europe. If you'd like to join us on the air, our email address is chrisarnsen@gmail.com, chrisarnsen@gmail.com, C-H-R-I-S. ARNZEN@gmail.com. I just wanted to highlight a few upcoming broadcasts in the near future that we're going to be having on Iron Sharpens Iron. This coming Monday, October 26th, we have two former Muslims on. The first hour, we're going to have Thabiti Anyabwile, and he is going to be discussing reviving the black church. Thabiti Anyabwile is an African-American who was raised in a Christian home and was a convert to Islam, and then later, by God's mercy, became a born-again believer in Christ, and now professes the faith that he once knew as a child in Jesus Christ as his Lord, God, and Savior. And I'm looking forward to having Thabiti back on the program. He had been a guest several times on the old Iron Sharpens Iron, and this is the first time he's been on the all-new Iron Sharpens Iron. So we're looking forward to that. We also have right after Thabiti on Monday from 5 to 6 p.m., we have Kareem Samshi Basha, who is also a former Muslim. He was actually raised in a Muslim home and by Christ's mercy is now a born-again believer in Jesus Christ. And we're going to be hearing about his remarkable testimony, which is chronicled in a book that he has written, Paul and Me, and that is published by Solid Ground Christian Books in Birmingham, Alabama. And let me give a little plug to them again. That's solid-ground-books.com. Solid-ground-books.com. Also, on the same theme that we're addressing, Islam, we have on November 9th, which is a Monday, we have Gordon Nickel for the very first time on Iron Sharpens Iron. He is going to be discussing his book, The Gentle Answer to the Muslim Accusation of Biblical Falsification. And our guest today said he is familiar with Gordon Nickel, and I hope that you could join us for that program. And I have a heads up for you. We are going to be giving away copies of that book on November 9th. The Gentle Answer by Gordon Nickel, but we're only giving them away to people who are serious about evangelizing Muslims. People who are pastors, or they are in some kind of a ministry where they are actively involved in evangelizing Muslims. This is far too valuable a book to give away to anyone that may have it just gathering dust on a shelf or being used as a coaster on the coffee table. So if you are seriously and actively involved in Christian evangelizing Muslims, the Christian evangelizing of Muslims, please make sure you mark on your calendar that Monday, November 9th, we are going to be interviewing Gordon Nickel and giving away his book. And once again, our email address here for those of you who wish to ask a question of our guest today, Dr. Tony Costa, is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. And we do have a listener in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, Harrison, who asks, I know that your guest is Canadian, and I'm not sure how familiar he is with our president, Barack Obama, but many have accused Mr. Obama of being secretly Muslim, and I don't understand how that could wash, knowing of his overtly liberal policies and beliefs that appear to radically contradict Islam. So that would be a question for you, Dr. Costa, if you care to comment.
Yes. Barack Obama was born a Muslim. He was born in a Muslim country to Muslim parents. And so in Islam, if you're born from a Muslim father in particular, you are a Muslim. Hmm. Now, he openly admitted that he went to the madrasas, which are Islamic schools. He claims that one of the most beautiful sounds he heard in the morning was the adhan, which is the call to prayer from the minarets. But then later, he claimed to have converted to Christianity. Now, the issue here is, and I'm not going to go into the debate whether or not he was an American, he has an American birth certificate or not, or whether he's a Muslim or not, because he was definitely born Muslim. He speaks very highly of Islam. In fact, when he was in Al-Azhar University in Cairo, which is considered the Vatican of Islam, he spoke highly. He said Islam gave us science, Islam gave us mathematics, Islam gave us all of these wonderful things and inventions, a lot of which can be disputed. But it's interesting, whenever Mr. Obama has spoken about the Bible or Christianity, he seems to speak of the Bible disparagingly. He attacks the Mosaic laws concerning slavery. He has also spoken against, instead of dealing with terrorism straight on, he's referred to the Crusades as one of those, you know, well, Christians had the Crusades, so there's violence in every religion. He refuses to call the Fort Hood massacre a terrorist act. He referred to it as a workplace violence, where it was clearly terrorist in content. The assailant was crying out Allahu Akbar, and while he was killing the servicemen. But at the same time, what type of Christianity does Mr. Obama hold to? I mean, he was part of Jeremy Wright's church, which subscribed to a black liberation theology, and he is famous for saying in one of his sermons, he said, not for God to bless America. He actually said, and excuse my language, he said, God damn America. What type of a Christian would that be? So I'm not going to say whether or not he's a Muslim. He seems to be very amicable towards Islam. He speaks very highly about the Quran and so forth. And he almost seems reticent to use the word terrorism in relation to Islam. I think a lot of that is baggage from his younger days, but I do think he is very sympathetic towards Islam.
Yeah, that is an irony, because he is liberal. I mean, he's in favor of same-sex marriage and all these things that that Muslims find abhorrent.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to the homosexual issue in a minute, though, because there seems to be quite an ironic thing going on in Islam in regard to that. But there are also other liberals that have, for some reason, praised Islam and while simultaneously blasting Christianity and slandering it and mocking it.
If I could just add this, Chris, if I can. When the Chattanooga Muslim went and killed a number of the servicemen in the state of Tennessee, it took the White House 5 days to lower the flag. And you have to ask the question, why did it take that long to lower the flag in memory of these fallen servicemen? When the Supreme Court decision, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided on same-sex marriage, the White House was ablaze with rainbow colors immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask the question, what took the president 5 days to order the flag to be lowered on the White House in sign of mourning for these servicemen in Chattanooga? So it's these types of things that just make your eyebrows rise. Well, he seems to be very, very comfortable with Islam.
Now, why do you think that is, other than the fact that he may be secretly Muslim, why would liberals of any sort do that? Because they do. Liberals who would be the first to have the sword against their throats if they were living in a nation under Sharia law, for all kinds of insane things that liberals believe in and practice. Why? What is the story behind that in your opinion?
I think bottom line, Chris, I think there is a cultural hatred towards Christianity. Remember, Christianity has, for some reason, even in our colleges and universities, we see a revisionist history taking place. It was white European Christians who enslaved the blacks. It was the white Europeans who colonized the world and took advantage of the minorities. There is a very anti-Christian streak, even in our academia. But Islam is considered different. It's something that is part of what was believed to be the minority at one time. And for some strange reason, liberals have no problem attacking Jesus, attacking Christianity, attacking churches. And there seems to be an anti-Christian sentiment in America. At the same time, it's considered one of the most pious nations on the earth. But politically speaking, it seems to be perfectly fine to attack Christianity. I think that the question here, Chris, is also deeply spiritual as well. There is a reason why the Christian faith is opposed and hated. Islam as a religion, really, when you look at it, does appeal to the unregenerate nature of man. It permits man to have four wives. He can have an unlimited number of sex slaves if he engages in jihad and conquers a certain culture, a certain nation, and so forth. Bill Maher, I think, is the only liberal fellow who's had the guts to come out and actually call Islam what it is. And I think Richard Dawkins recently was on his show, and Richard Dawkins now is echoing the same idea. At least Maher is consistent in attacking Christianity
right. And
Islam and every other religion.
Yeah, he's because of his disdain for all religion.
Yes, I think there's a fear factor, too. I think a lot of these liberals know that if they were to say anything against Islam or even Muhammad, they know what the consequences would be. So just like the Christian bakers are being put out of business and sued, they won't do the same when it comes to the Muslims.
Going back to the issue of homosexuality, I have heard from a number of people that seem to be very credible, including one that was in the military who was specifically during the Gulf War was trained. Part of the training was that they said that the Muslims, much to the surprise of many Westerners, unmarried young Muslim men do practice homosexuality, and it's almost winked at, and there's a blind eye turned to it until someone gets married. And I wanted you to sift through from fiction in this topic. Also, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Kite Runner, but it seemed that male pedophilia involving young boys who are forced to dress up like girls and dance and so forth.
Yeah.
It was rampant even among the Taliban and people involved in the most strict form of Islam.
Yes, yes. That is true. In fact, when you look at the percentage-wise, the country that has more hits on the websites, on the internet, with pedophilia or just hardcore pornography, the country that has the most hits is Pakistan. And also in Pakistan, there is an area, there's a city called Peshawar. And in Peshawar, Pakistan, you have a very high rate of pederasty there, where young boys are being used for sexual pleasure by men because they feel that if you did that with women, would constitute fornication, and that could bring the death penalty. But the interesting thing here is that in Islam, under Sharia law, homosexual sex or sodomy is also punishable by death. But for some strange reason, they treat these minors as, they're not really adults, and so it's okay. In Afghanistan, there was a documentary done in 2010 called The Dancing Boys of Afghanistan. And it's a practice called Bakabazi, and this has to do with the so-called dancing boys who dress up as girls. They put on makeup and they adorn themselves in a very effeminate way. And it's very common in Afghanistan. In fact, some U.S. servicemen were complaining about the fact that Afghani soldiers were sexually abusing these children. And they were later told by their superiors not just to turn the other way, look the other way. So it does go on in these cultures. Officially, it is forbidden in Islam, but it does go on in Pakistan. It does go on in Afghanistan.
Do you think a lot of it could be because of the misogyny of Islam?
Yeah.
They would be much more willing and eager to execute women involving before sexual activity outside of marriage, but the men, they don't.
Under Sharia law, if a woman is raped, and here's one of the strangest texts in the Quran. Under Sharia law, as detailed in the Quran, if a woman is raped, she has to produce four witnesses that to claim that she was raped. Every rape is non-consensual, but to claim that she's been raped and she wants justice, she would have to provide four witnesses. Now, how many women do you know can provide four witnesses to the rape unless the four witnesses are the rapist themselves? And so women are extremely vulnerable in Islamic countries. If they are raped, most of them are accused of fornication and end up usually being killed. There's the issue of honor killings in Islam. 91% of honor killings are committed by Muslims. And so this is a serious problem. And the ones who suffer in these honor crimes are women.
And is there any truth to the fact that the American military, especially in Afghanistan, seems to be fond of sporting beards as to not give off the false impression that they're homosexual?
That I've not heard of. What I have heard of is that, particularly during the Gulf War, many of the Americans, the American soldiers, Marines that were working, that were engaging in the airstrikes against Iraq at the time, many of them were told to take off their crosses, take off any jewelry that bore the cross. They were not allowed to drink any alcohol, and basically conform to Sharia law.
Okay, we do have a listener, Arnie in Perry County, Pennsylvania, who wants to know, what sect of Islam do you think poses the greatest threat in the on the globe?
Well, I would say Sunni, definitely. They are the majority. But the Shias as well. The Shias do believe in the concept of jihad. Iran is a huge human rights violator. Even today, there are Americans who are imprisoned in Iran. Some of them just because they converted to Christianity, or there's a pastor who's languishing there in prison. And the odd thing is that when President Obama and his delegates were meeting over the whole nuclear deal, nothing was said to secure the release of these Americans, which I think was deplorable. But Sunni, definitely number one. 85% of Muslims are Sunni, and I think they would be the major threat. All the attacks in the United States that have taken place since 9/11 have all been committed by Sunnis.
We have CJ in Lindenhurst, Long Island, who asks, are those of other Islamic sects outside of Sunni who immigrate to the United States more commonly prone to join Sunni mosques because of the lack of threat of violence here? And I'm assuming our listener would, in his question, include Canada, because that's where you're from.
Right, right. Well, I think the smaller sects of Islam, like the Ismailis, for instance, the Ismailis are not really, they don't really follow the Sharia in Islam. They're much more left-wing. But there are a lot of Muslims that come to America that become, let's just say, disengaged with the culture, and they want to rediscover their roots. And a lot of them do usually end up going into the mosques, and many of them become radicalized there. That's a problem that we have up here in Canada as well. But the majority of them, in the majority of cases, yes, they are the Sunnis. The Sunnis are much more austere, much more rigorous in their observance of Islam and Sharia law.
Yeah, well, I'm assuming that the question involves the fact that there are more Sunnis in America and North America in general. And since there might not be a mosque of a different sect that's readily available to another sect.
Yeah, they usually try to stick to their own, because they have their own cultural differences. But that's not to say that you can convert within. I knew a Muslim fellow who I debated, who went from being an Ahmadiyya to becoming a Sunni Muslim, and now he's left Islam. He's now kind of waiting and wondering, you know, what religion or what true faith is the one that he should follow now. But there is cases where Muslims do convert interdenominationally.
Mm-hmm. And just to get it out of the way, in case somebody's wondering, we did do a whole program recently, a 2-hour program on the Nation of Islam. That is not an Islamic religion at all. It's a cult that just claims some adherence to.
Right. It's a group that started in the United States under a Wallace Fard, mm-hmm. who has been followed by Elijah Muhammad, and then it splintered after the death of Elijah Muhammad. So there are a few of these splinter groups that claim allegiance to the Nation of Islam, but the predominant body is led by Louis Farrakhan.
Right.
And the Nation of Islam basically is not considered mainstream at all. It's basically a religion that says that all the prophets were black, Jesus was black, Allah is black, and the true Muslims are black, and the white men, the white folks, are white devils. And in fact, the Nation of Islam teaches that you and I, Chris, because we're white men, the white race was basically a chemistry experimentation that went wrong, created by an evil entity. So that's where the white race falls in. But the Nation of Islam is definitely not considered Islam.
Like some kind of a mad scientist or something, correct?
Yeah, we're the product of, his name is Yaqub, which is very interesting. It sounds like the name Jacob in Hebrew. But they believe that some scientist screwed up on an experiment and this brought about the white race. Some people think I'm just making this up, that it's just science fiction, but it's this is official teaching.
And they are clearly not Orthodox Muslims.
No.
For lack of a better term, because they are violating shirk. They, by identifying God as a, or Allah as a black man,
yes,
they are violating the most serious prohibition in their religion, correct?
That's right. And they also believe that Wallace Fard, who was the founder, Wallace Fard, they said, was Allah himself in the flesh. And that is absolutely shirk and blasphemous in Islam to assert the incarnation.
Right, so you wonder if they really even read the Quran, although they claim some adherence to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how could they overlook that that prohibition in the Quran about shirk?
Right, it's simply reinterpreted by Farrakhan and their leaders.
Yes, and it is interesting. This has come up before on this program and in some of the debates that I've organized with Dr. James White. But it is interesting how the Quran repudiates the Trinity and yet defines it in a way that no Christian has ever defined it,
right,
including
right.
Mary as a part of the Godhead.
Right. Well, the Quran never uses the word Trinity.
Right, right.
It doesn't. It uses the word thalatha, which is the word for three.
Right.
So when the Quran says, say not three, we have to ask, well, what the three what? Because the Quran assumes, as you rightly noted, that the Christians worship Allah, Mary, and Jesus. So you've got the Father, the Mother, and the Son. So they think, the Quran teaches that Christians think that God had a consort, and through his consort he produced Jesus. So the very, very literal, vulgar interpretation of the incarnation.
And we're going to be going to our final break now, and this is your final opportunity to email us a question for Dr. Tony Costa on Islam, or in more in particular, the migrant crisis and Islamic expansion in Europe. Our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen@gmail.com. That's chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And please include your first name, city and state, and country of residence if you live outside the USA. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Tony Costa of Toronto Baptist Seminary.
Attention coin collectors and investors, Long Island Galleries of Wading River, New York has brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars for only $54 per coin, with free shipping and handling for a limited time. There's a 40-coin limit, so order now while supplies last. Call 888-260-8111, 888-260-8111. Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express welcome. Prices subject to change, so call now at 888-260-8111. 888-260-8111. If you prefer ordering your brilliant, uncirculated 19th century Morgan silver dollars by check, mail it today to Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. That's Long Island Galleries, 9 Susan Drive, Wading River, New York, 11792. Remember, they're only $54 per coin with free shipping and handling and a 40-coin limit. New York State residents must add sales tax. Long Island Galleries is honored to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. See the Long Island Galleries display ad at ironsharpensironradio.com.
Lynbrook Baptist Church on 225 Earl Avenue in Lynbrook, Long Island, is teaching God's timeless truths in the 21st century.
Our church is far more than a Sunday worship service.
It's a place of learning where the scriptures are studied and the preaching of the gospel is clear and relevant.
It's like a gym where one can exercise their faith through community involvement.
It's like a hospital for wounded souls where one can find compassionate people and healing.
We're a diverse family of all ages,
enthusiastically serving our Lord Jesus Christ
in fellowship, play, and together.
Hi, I'm Pastor Paul Waldeman, and I invite you to come and join us here at Lynbrook Baptist Church and see all that a church can be.
Call Lynbrook Baptist at 516-599-9402. That's 516-599-9402, or visit lynbrookbaptist.org. That's lynbrookbaptist.org.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Are you a Christian looking to align your faith and finances? Then you'll want to check out Thrivent Financial. We're not your typical financial services provider. We're a not-for-profit Fortune 500 organization that helps our nearly 2.4 million members be wise with money. We provide guidance that reflects your values so you can protect what matters most. We help members live generously and strengthen the communities where they live, work, and worship. Learn more about the Thrivent story by contacting me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Welcome back. This is Chris Arnes, and if you just tuned us in for the last 90 minutes, we have had Dr. Tony Costa of Toronto Baptist Seminary on our program today discussing the migrant crisis and Islamic expansion in Europe. And if you'd like to join us on the air, you've only got about 20 minutes to do so. That's chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen at gmail.com. We do have... another listener here in Pennsylvania. We have Titus, who is in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, asking, other than setting up theocracies in different parts of the world that are not Muslim, how can we stop the Islamic spread throughout Europe and even North America and elsewhere?
Well, we have to understand, of course, education is the key word. You have to know what you're dealing with. You can't fight something you don't know. Unless you know what it is, you can't stop it. So the first thing we have to do, I mean, there's been some cases, even in the United States, in Oklahoma, for instance, where they tried to establish Sharia courts. And I believe the high state of Oklahoma shot that down. So one of the things we have to do is we have to alert those in government, or congressmen, or your congressmen, senators, and so forth. I think that they have to be made aware that Islam is not just religion, it is a political movement as well. We also have to make them aware that Sharia is incompatible with democratic values. I mean, Ben Carson got in big trouble, if you remember, for saying that an American president cannot be a Muslim. And what he was trying to say by that is that as a Muslim, his first and his first commitment is to Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with Sharia law is it does not recognize equality. There, men and women are not equal. There is no equality of speech, for instance,
mm-hmm.
religion, no freedom of religion, and so forth. And so the only way we can stop this type of expansion is we have to know what we're dealing with, and that is we are also dealing with a political movement that sees itself as supreme, that sees itself as taking over the world. And this is not fear-mongering. This is simply what the Quran says, that Islam will become dominant and triumphant over all religions. And so the key here is information, getting to know what Islam is. Our churches have to become aware of this. Many of our churches are abysmally ignorant about Islam and its political threat to the West. And so I think educating ourselves, educating those in government about these dangers, I think is absolutely, absolutely important.
And Ben Carson was saying that he did not want a Muslim to be president of the United States.
Right.
And he didn't say that. I don't believe that it was against the laws of America, the United States. But
right.
But I don't want a Muslim to be president of the United States either. And
right.
I think that anybody but a strict Muslim should not find anything bizarre or hateful or bigoted in that at all.
No, not at all. Not at all, because they know that that Islamic law does have certain tenets that violate democratic laws.
Yes, and my friend Pastor David Dykstra, he wrote a book a number of years ago called Yearning to Breathe Free, Thoughts on Immigration, Islam, and Freedom. And the title of the book comes from the Emma Lazarus poem on the base of the Statue of Liberty monument.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual poem, what everybody always refers to when they are saying, oh, we can't discriminate against people's religious beliefs when they come here. That's against the very basis of our concept of freedom and freedom of speech and freedom of religion. Well, it's interesting that the poem at the base of our Statue of Liberty's the monument, national monument, it says, with silent lips, cries she, with silent lips, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless tempest, toast to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Now, Muslims, if they are true and faithful to the Quran and the Hadith, they are not yearning to breathe free.
No, you see, Chris, this all comes back to the Islamic worldview. The paradigm in Islam is that between a master and a slave. Because in Islam, God is not father. He cannot be addressed as father. God is the master, and you are the slave. In fact, Islam means submission, surrender. A Muslim is one who submits. And so the paradigm is master-slave. A master does not owe his slave anything. The slave owes abject obedience to the master. He owes everything to the master. And so within the Islamic framework, the idea is not that of being free and enjoying freedom. It's the idea of being enslaved to Allah. And the favorite name that Muslims usually go by is the name Abdullah. Abdullah means the slave of Allah. In Christianity, you'll notice the paradigm is so different. Yes, we are the servants of God, but we are also children of God. And God, as a father, loves his children. God provides for his children, and God seeks the betterment, the salvation of his people. But that is not what you find in Islam. The God of Islam is very so transcendent, he cannot come down to us. The God of Islam is very fickle. He could choose you, he could throw you to the side, he can do whatever he wants with his creation. In fact, the Quran says that he will fill all of hell with men. So it's a very different paradigm. And if you're used to believing that the highest aspiration is to be a slave of Allah, then the concept of democracy and freedom is something that is almost foreign to the Islamic worldview.
You have debated Muslims. You have interacted with Muslims that truly believe that the Quran is from Allah, and they truly believe in the teachings of the Hadith. Do you believe that these folks, well, first let me ask you, what percentage of them, if any, reveal openly a solidarity with the terrorists of the world, ISIS and so on? And if they do not, if they claim some kind of abhorrence or opposition to that, do you believe it is genuine? And if so, how could they adhere faithfully to the Quran and the Hadith and yet oppose these things?
Well, the thing is, we keep hearing a lot in the media about moderate Muslims and moderate Islam, and I always ask the same question over and over again. Where are all these moderate Muslims? Where are the protests? Where are their protests coming together and announcing publicly, without reservation, that we condemn ISIS, we condemn what's going on around the world? We don't see this. And so silence at times can be taken as assent. But in terms of the Muslims that I've debated, some of them have been quiet about it. Some of them seem to not want to touch the subject. Others, there's one in particular, who seems to want to revise Islam or even sanitize it. He claims that the Hadith cannot really be trusted. And so the odd thing here is that on the one hand, they're claiming to be true Muslims, but on the other hand, they're selectively picking and choosing the so-called peaceful verses from the Quran and trying to say that Muslims who act violently are not really Muslims. And so you wonder, are these Muslims being straightforward with you? Are they practicing taqiyya? Because once again, the concept of taqiyya is to advance Islam by lying. And so that's the issue here. Can they be trusted? Now, that's not to say, Chris, that there are not moderate Muslims, in the sense that are there Muslims in the United States and Canada that are freedom-loving? Yes, there are, but they're not being consistent Muslims. They're not following the dictates of Islam fully. And so in that case, they would not be truly representative of what Islam is.
Yeah, how could you distrust the Hadith and be truly representative of Islam? Are you speaking of the Quran only group, which is a very
tall? No, I'm speaking of a Sunni Muslim scholar who is basically saying that we can't really trust the Hadith or the early biography of Muhammad by Ibn Ishaq, and these are startling statements. But he's not a Qurani. The Quranis are a modern group that have emerged within Islam that claim that only the Quran is inspired, we don't need the Hadith or anything like that. But traditionally, Sunni and Shia Islam have always affirmed that the Hadith are the second inspiration, only second to the Quran.
Yes, I don't know if you're familiar with Hamza Abdul Malik.
Yes.
He was the very first Muslim that Dr. James R. White ever debated, that I arranged the debate here on Long Island.
Right.
And Hamza, at the time, was a Sunni and has since become a Qurani, which he only believes in the Quran and not the Hadith, which makes sense.
That's right. And he would be considered heretical by mainstream Islam for doing that.
Yes. It was interesting that even the Ahmadiyya imam that I had lunch with, he thought that that was an untenable view of Islam.
And that's because, Chris, that if you're supposed to imitate Muhammad, then how are you supposed to know how to imitate him if you don't have any biographical information about how he popped, how he dressed, what he did in this situation, how he treated Jews and Christians? In other words, even the fact that Muslims pray five times a day, the five-time-a-day prayer is not based on the Quran. The Quran teaches three times a day.
Right.
The five times a day is based on the Hadith of al-Bukhari. So if you get rid of the Hadith, then you might as well start praying three times a day instead of five, because the Quran mandates the three time a day prayer.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, Hamza doesn't do a lot of those things that he used to do. A very very nice man. I really enjoy speaking with him, and he's a very friendly guy. He has come to many of James White's debates, even with Roman Catholics, and
right.
So we can only pray for him to come to the truth of Christ. I really want to make sure that before we run out of time that you really unburden your heart and let our listeners know precisely what you want most etched on their hearts and minds before they leave the show today. So speak freely with issues that you really want to address and hammer down.
Right. Well, first of all, let me say that that God is saving Muslims. There are Muslims that are coming to faith. I've had the great honor of baptizing a number of them, and families and individuals who've come to Christ, and some of them through ministries like my own and Dr. White's and others who have been workers in the field of reaching out to Muslims. So the first thing I want to say is that we should not be discouraged by this news that somehow we're being overshadowed by Islam. But the good news is that the gospel is the power of God to save. It is saving Muslims. And this is one of the reasons why the gospel is hindered and churches are destroyed, because I believe that ISIS understands, as any other Muslim does, that the gospel does indeed save. It has an effect of power. So don't be discouraged. That's the first thing. The second thing we have to realize is we must be educated on Islam. We cannot afford to put our heads in the sand and ignore this. Islam is here. It's here to stay. We have to deal with the fact that our shores are being are gateways that Muslims are coming through. And I think that, yes, in one sense, Islam politically is a threat that we ought to be aware of. I think we also have to see this as a move of God to bring these people to our shores so that they too can hear the gospel, so that when we confront our Muslim neighbors, our reaction should not be one of fear. Our reaction should be one of, this is a human being made in the image of God, and what can I do to share the gospel with this person? And so I think it's very important that we understand that at the end of the day, Muslims are human beings made in the image of God. They are human beings that we owe a debt to give the gospel to them. They are part of the Great Commission. But at the same time, we also have to realize we have to distinguish the worldview. Islam does contain a worldview that is adverse to Western values. It does have a supremacist ideology. It is totalitarian in the sense that Islam has a global vision to bring all the world under the hegemony of Islam. Muhammad said that I've been commanded by Allah to fight the people until they confess that there is no God but Allah and I am his messenger. In other words, the marching orders that Muhammad gave his followers was that they are to engage ultimately in offensive fighting to bring the world under the Muslim rule. However, we have a much powerful tool. The gospel is God's power. And the good news is that God is still sovereign. God rules, the Lord reigns, and he does whatever he pleases. And so we need to rest assured in this fact that God reigns. He is on the throne, and that with the power of the gospel, we can see a lot of these Muslims come to Christ. The good news is there are many, many, many Muslims in the Muslim world today who are coming to Christ in great numbers. I've heard statistics showing more so now than any other time in history. So we must not lose sight of the fact that our God works all things according to the great counsel of his will. He's doing it to his glory, and we have a challenge before us. The church must become, indeed, the church triumphant, stand up for Jesus, as the hymn says, lift high his royal banner, it must not suffer loss, till every foe is vanquished, and Christ is Lord indeed.
Amen. And if you could also let us know, I know that individuals are individuals, and they vary from person to person in the way that you should approach them with the gospel and so on. But as far as opening comments to spark conversation with Muslims, what do you suggest if you're sitting and having lunch with a colleague or a neighbor or someone? Perhaps you just noticed that they may have a Quran in a restaurant or something that makes them stand out, that you would see them as possibly being Muslim, wearing a kufi or something.
Well, what I find that's very instrumental is talking to Muslims about assurance of salvation. Islam does not teach assurance. salvation. Ultimately, it's Allah who wills it, and Allah can do with you whatever he pleases. And the one thing that Muslims do not have is they don't have assurance that sins are forgiven. It's all based on a merit system. The more good works I do, I may enter paradise, but there is no certainty. The Quran gives no assurance of this. So the one thing I always emphasize is peace with God. I have peace with God through Jesus Christ. You have this peace. You know that if you were to leave this world today, that you would be in the presence of God. I've not yet met a Muslim who has confessed that he had that assurance. So they lack that assurance. You may give them your testimony how you've come to have this peace with God. I would also mention the fact that in the Quran, Jesus is mentioned 25 times by name. Muhammad is only mentioned 4 times. In the Quran, Jesus is called the Word of God. He is said to be virgin-born. He is sinless, faultless. He does miracles. Muhammad doesn't do any of these things. And so I would ask my Muslim friends, why is Jesus given such an elevated role in the Quran? Why is he called the Word of God? Why is he mentioned 25 times, whereas Muhammad is only mentioned 4 times by name? So these are great conversation starters. And I think it's also important to tell our Muslim friends that, you know, the idea that Jesus is the Son of God by literal reproduction and so forth, they need to be corrected on this, because they think that we as Christians believe that God sexually procreated Jesus through Mary. They think that we believe in three gods. The Quran says Christians are teaching polytheism. And these are great opportunities to clarify what we actually believe.
Oh, so they actually believe as the Mormons believe? They believe that Christians view the conception of Christ in the same way that the Mormons view that?
That's correct. So I've always told my Muslim friends, I said, I think Muhammad got us confused with Brigham Young. because it was Brigham Young who first taught this doctrine that Jesus was conceived by, he believed it was Adam God. He believed Adam was the God of this world. And so it was actually Brigham Young who taught the physical conception, the physical reproduction of Jesus Christ's body by God the Father and the Virgin Mary. No Christian in Christian history has ever taught that God
Such a thing.
That's considered just as blasphemous to us as it is to the Muslims.
Right, and most Mormons today, especially young ones, have never heard that either.
No, they haven't. But it's clearly there in the early teachings.
Yes.
And in fact, it's still taught today by the Mormon authorities. It's just not as explicit.
But the Muslims do believe, obviously they deny his deity, but they believe in his virgin birth, do they not?
Absolutely, but we have to be clear here that they believe that his virgin birth, the Quran says that Jesus is just like Adam. Adam was created directly by God, and Jesus was directly created by God in the womb of the Virgin Mary. So his conception was a result of basically God saying be, and he was. And so the Quran does not say that, that there is an indication that Jesus was the Word from Allah, which is very strange, because it seems to be borrowing the language of John's Gospel.
Right. There.
But the Quran says that Jesus was a creation just as much as Adam was, and he was directly created by God's spoken word.
And it is ironic that they believe Muhammad to be the better prophet.
Yes.
And yet they admit that Muhammad had sin. They admit that Muhammad was not born of a virgin.
Right.
They do teach that Jesus was sinless, born of a virgin, and is the Messiah, correct?
Yes. His name in the Quran is Isa al-Masih, Jesus the Messiah. So absolutely.
And they believe, and they don't believe in his resurrection because they don't believe he died.
That's right. So Surah 4:157 says that they crucified him not, nor did they kill him. So no death, no resurrection. You can't have resurrection without death. So the Hadith projects his coming into the future, where he comes back as a jihadi, and then it says he will die. He will live for 40 years. He will die, and he'll be buried next to Muhammad in Medina. And then at the very end, he'll be resurrected with Muhammad and everyone else.
Oh wow, that's kind of strange. After all that, Jesus is going to die.
Well, because he never died, you see. He was whisked away, and the Quran says that Jesus said, "Peace be upon me the day I was born, the day I die, the day I shall be raised." Well, the Muslim commentator says, okay, we've got a problem. Jesus didn't die, so what they did was they projected this into the future where he would come back as a jihadi, and eventually he would die, and therefore he would be resurrected.
Now, I know that Muslims are by nature vehemently opposed to idolatry. But I have heard that sometimes Muslims can be seen at, like, Medjugorje and places like that. Do you know of that kind of a thing happening?
Yeah, it's not unusual. There are some, there's a folk Islam, believe it or not. Muslims can also be very highly superstitious. They will have amulets in their homes. They'll have the, they're very superstitious of the evil eye. You know, the Italians speak of the Malayoki.
Right.
And so the last two chapters of the Quran, chapter 113, 114, you have their incantations that are meant to ward off evil. But it's interesting, Chris, because Muslims usually charge Christians with being cross worshippers. They worship the cross. But here's the irony, is that when they do their pilgrimage, the Hajj in Mecca, when they run around the Kaaba, there's a stone there in the corner of the Kaaba, which Muslim legend says was sent down from heaven, but geologists have actually confirmed it's nothing but a meteorite. But what Muslims do at the end of the Hajj is they circumambulate the Kaaba seven times, and then they'll go up to this stone and they will kiss it and caress it.
Yeah.
And so can we say that Muslims are stone worshippers? I mean, we don't worship the cross unless you see elements of that in the Roman Catholic Church and some of the Orthodox churches.
Right.
That's true. That, yes, there is that type of idolatry there, but biblical Christianity, of course, we don't worship objects. We don't worship the cross. The cross is something, just a symbol, just like the Islamic, the crescent moon is a symbol of Islam. We don't charge them with worshiping the moon. But they certainly do caress and kiss the black stone at the conclusion of the Hajj, the pilgrimage.
Now, is that all Islamic sects or any opposed to that?
All Muslims perform the Hajj. The Hajj is one of the pillars of Islam. And whether you're Sunni, Shiite, or Ahmadiyya, you must perform the Hajj.
So they're all there together, then?
Yes, yes. But they're all dressed the same, so they can't tell the difference between a Sunni and a Shia. If there was, it'd be some serious problems. But in most cases, Sunnis and Shias, they all dress in a white robe, and they're virtually indistinguishable.
Now, I don't know, I know that you're on the faculty at Toronto Baptist Seminary, but I never asked you if you're a cessationist or a continuist regarding the sign gifts and that kind of thing. But I was wondering what you make of the number of Muslim converts to Christianity that claim a vision of some kind as a part of their transformation.
Well, I have met Christians personally here in Toronto. I spoke at a conference on the persecuted church, and I did meet some Muslims who ex-Muslims, that is, who truly suffered tremendously for their faith and tortured in prisons in Pakistan and elsewhere. And some of these Muslims came to faith because of a dream or a vision that they had. And the language that is used in this dream and in these visions are very similar to the language we find in the New Testament, where Saul of Tarsus, for instance, where Jesus says, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" And in all honesty, Chris, I believe these brothers. I don't think they're making it up. They suffered tremendously. They lost family members because of their conversion to Christianity. I don't think they would have made that up and then lose their families, lose their business, and then come to the point of putting their life on the line. Now, there are definitely stories that I've heard that I think are not genuine, but there are bona fide cases of true conversions where you see spiritual maturity. They're growing in Christ, and they experience what I can only call a Saul of Tarsus-like encounter.
Yes, when I called somebody who was hosting a program on the Trinity Channel, which I think you're probably familiar with.
I've been on there a number of times, and I've done debates there as well.
Right, yes, and the Reformed Baptist host said that in his experience, most of the converts, because he is a cessationist just as I am, and he said that most of the converts that he is aware of that had a vision involved do not see visions after their conversion ever again. It's not like an ongoing thing.
That's what I've also found out to be true, that after their conversion, they never saw this, they never had this experience repeated.
Yes, so that wouldn't be a classical charismatics or Pentecostal.
No, no, and the men that I've met who have encountered this, to my knowledge, are not charismatic.
And if you would care to share any contact information in the event that somebody wants to have you speak at their church or what have you.
Well, my website is tonycosta.webs.com. That's all one word, T-O-N-Y-C-O-S-T-A, .webs.com. And so there you have my contact information. There's a number of resources there, online debates that I've done. You can view them on YouTube and Trinity Channel shows and so forth.
Well, I thank you so much for being a part of our broadcast today. I look forward to having you back very soon. And I want everybody listening to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far, far greater Savior than you are a sinner. God bless, and we hope that you tune in tomorrow to Iron Sharpens Iron.